This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. Coming up, we hear how the Kalamazoo Area United Way is using screenings of a highly celebrated documentary to spark community conversation about the need to treat childhood trauma. The film highlights the foundings of a groundbreaking federal study that shows adverse childhood experiences, called ACEs for short, can alter the brain, leading to learning but also mental and physical health issues. To tell us more about the local awareness campaign, we're joined today by Jennifer Nottingham, Associate Director of Community Impact at the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo Region, and Diane Marquez, Director of Behavioral Services at Family and Children's Services. Welcome to WMUK.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're getting ready to show a film in Kalamazoo. It's called Resilience, The Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope. What is that film about?
The film reviews a seminal study done by Dr. Floody and Dr. Anda that was done in the mid-1990s that assessed the childhood experiences of over 17,000 individuals. And it looks specifically at what those adverse childhood experiences were and then how that affected life outcomes for those individuals. The five adverse childhood experiences that it examines are substance abuse, parental divorce, mental illness, whether or not there was domestic abuse, if there's an incarcerated parent, physical, sexual, or psychological abuse, and then physical and emotional neglect. What is the long-term impact of those on us? And then it talks about not just what the impact is, but what can we do about it? And the results of the study were pretty startling. I think what the film does uniquely is that it makes potentially very complicated information extremely accessible.
And the shorthand word for adverse childhood experiences, people may hear it throughout this conversation today, is ACEs.
Yes.
The study was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente. Mm-hmm. Permanente. That's a nonprofit healthcare provider based in California. What is the importance of knowing ACEs?
Several things. First of all, ACEs are very common. 66%, about two-thirds, identified as having at least one ACE. The other thing that we learned was that if you have one ACE, it's very likely that you have two or more. 87% of those individuals had two or more ACEs. Those ACEs, the more you have, the more challenged you are with a lot of life outcomes. So when you are comparing, for example, someone with no ACEs to someone with four ACEs, someone with four ACEs is twice as likely to be a smoker, seven times more likely to be an alcoholic, four times more likely to have lung cancer, three times as likely to have any kind of cancer, and 12 times more likely to attempt to commit suicide. You get up into the really high numbers. If you have six or more ACEs, that can cut 20 years off the person's lifespan. So it was one of the most remarkable and profound discoveries in public health that we've had in a long time, because what we've discovered is that adverse childhood experiences undercut almost every physical, social, mental, and emotional problem that we experience as a society.
Now, let's talk about the brain science behind that. What does childhood trauma do to the brain?
So you're familiar with fight or flight. Most of us are. That is the physiological response that our body has when there is a perceived threat. The amygdala takes a look at the environment, scans for a threat, and makes a decision about whether or not something is threatening or not. This was designed as a survival mechanism. The body is actually only designed to be in fight or flight mode for about 20 minutes. And it's supposed to help us decide whether or not, if there is a lion, tiger, or bear, or something threatening around, make that decision to run away or fight it. And in response to that, the hypothalamus gets activated and we have the sympathetic nervous system goes online. The body is flooded with cortisol and adrenaline, and we make that decision. The problem is that when we are under prolonged periods of stress, those experiences are there not just for that 20 minutes, but for very long periods of time, and it has a profound impact on the brain and our DNA.
So what it can do is those stress hormones actually have an influence on our cells, our chemicals, and the wiring of our brain. So they sculpt the brain for certain characteristics. So if you have those stress hormones released all the time, then you're going to have characteristics of being edgy, hot-tempered, impulsive, hypervigilant, or you could be withdrawn, dissociated, or numb. Now compare that to someone who doesn't have those stress hormones being put into their brain all the time. That person, their wiring and their chemistry of their brain allows them to be more focused, flexible, and relationship oriented.
So we can get a sense of the scope of this problem. Some people may say, maybe that's not me. In the general population, what percentage of people would have ACEs?
In Michigan, it's about 64%, so close to two-thirds. It's very similar to what the national study would indicate. So about two-thirds of individuals have at least one ACE.
This study was done in the mid-90s. What's giving it some momentum right now? Why are we talking about this now?
I think in a lot of cases, things just take a while to catch on. People were talking about it some then, but more and more research was done. So the study was done in the mid-90s, but more deeper research to identify its impact on life outcomes came later. And I think as a movement, a lot of people actually have been talking about trauma for 15, 20 years. And you'll get some experienced professionals in the mental health field that'll be like, this isn't new to us. We've known about this. I think what's new is that we're having videos like Resilience make it more accessible to the average layperson so that more and more people are paying attention to it. Whereas before it used to be sort of a mental health issue and that's all the people that were talking about it, now everybody recognizes that this isn't them, this is us, this is all of us, and we need to do something about it.
I think also, too, we've been talking a lot more recently about integrated health. So as Jennifer had referenced, we are looking at both the physical and the mental health of a person. So we can't just, you know, take care of the body from the neck down and keep the head separate. That's been a movement that's been happening for quite some time, too, but hopefully catching on more. And I think, as Jennifer said, we're connecting the two. So people who have these traumatic experiences may be more likely to have an anxiety disorder, but they're also more likely to have a cardiovascular disease or allergies or asthma. And I think sometimes when you put those two together, it can be more relatable instead of compartmentalizing them.
Let's talk about how you're trying to wrap your arms around that locally. You have a work committee called Raising Kalamazoo County. You've mm-hmm. been meeting for a couple of years now. Can you tell us about how that transformed into what you're doing now?
Sure. It was actually in fall of 2015 that we offered a screening of a movie called The Raising of America. And it was all about early childhood and how important experiences in early childhood are. When we looked at the evaluation data, the place that everybody wanted to focus on to influence and improve early childhood outcomes was policy. But policy is really big. And so the next question we asked was, where in policy do you want to focus? And given all of this energy around trauma and toxic stress and building resilience, that particular issue was identified overwhelmingly by the group. But then there was the fact that we have all this great work around trauma going on. We're trying to figure out a policy issue, but nobody's talking with one another. So the decision was made that before we actually identify an issue to focus on within policy, we needed to get our own systems and supports aligned. We needed to raise awareness about the issue. And that's when the work group began to very intentionally focus on the issue of trauma and the systems and supports. The work group has two goals. One is around raising awareness about the issue through things like the documentary screening and having conversations about that, as well as helping the organizations that see that and now are very interested in becoming trauma-informed, putting resources in place to support that, as well as coordinating and increasing communication and collaboration among the organizations that are committed to that. So those are the two goals of the work group.
And you have a cross-section of organizations and agencies involved. You have mental health. You have educators.
Educators, ISAAC, so the faith-based community, Western Michigan University, WMED. We have early childhood, which includes like Casey Ready Fours, the Great Start Collaborative, out-of-school time programs through KidNet. We do have, as you mentioned, community mental health, family and children's services. Kalamazoo Public Schools is at the table, as is communities and schools. The Help Now Fund, several community organizations such as YWCA, Community Healthcare Connections, trauma-informed organizations like Children's Trauma Assessment Center and Trauma Recovery Associates. Even the court system, Ninth Circuit Court, is involved at this point.
You're listening to WMUK's West Southwest. We're talking to Jennifer Nottingham from the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo region and Diane Marquez from Family and Children's Services about the United Way-led public awareness campaign about the harmful effects of adverse child experiences, called ACEs for short. United Way has been hosting public screenings of the documentary Resilience, The Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope. We continue the conversation with the United Way's Miss Nottingham, talking about the two screenings that's been held in Kalamazoo to date and the one planned for Tuesday, November 14th at WMU's Medical School.
We offered one in July at Kyrisa, and about 130 people attended that. We had the one at the juvenile home, and that was attended by judges, law enforcement, physicians. We had over 200 attend that one. And then we're offering another screening at WMed, focused more on the health sector, so a lot of medical students and medical staff are.
And that's Western Michigan University's Homer Stryker School of Medicine.
And that's on the 14th. And we have another screening in December. Kalamazoo Public Schools and Communities and Schools are offering that to educators. But we plan on having lots more screenings, because what we know is that collectively, if we're going to address this issue as a community, everybody needs to know about it. So we can't do a few screenings and then assume that we're done. We have to keep on raising awareness until we reach a tipping point and everybody's talking about
it. And the general public is invited to any of these, and it's free.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd like to talk solutions. I know that when it comes to reversing the harm of childhood trauma, it's been shown that one caring adult can make a difference. What other things can be done, and what's being done locally?
So kind of looking at different ways that we can hopefully prevent or reduce the incidence of people experiencing trauma, you can look at it as we need to have three protective systems. So one of them is the individual themselves and what their capabilities are. The second one would be, as you referenced, an attachment and belonging with a person who's caring and competent. So that's why these awareness showings and raising that is important as well, too. So caring is being one thing, but we also need people to be competent about what's happening to individuals as well. And then the third thing is having that protective community. So having the community as a whole being a place where we can support and encourage people. So those are different things that we can do. Something that's been around a long time also has been a program called, it's a philosophy of strengthening families. And there are five protective factors for families and for children. And that would be, one of them would be having a social and emotional competence of children. So we're helping children create those. That parents have knowledge of parenting and child development so they can support their children the best way they can. That they have social connections. That they have concrete support in times of need. And that we are supporting parental resilience. So we're kind of helping build that. So if we do all of those types of things, we can helpfully create that environment that's going to be preventative.
Students that have in their background several ACEs, they get suspended more often. And what does this look like in the school system? I'm reading, you know, having problems paying attention.
What's going on there, right? Like, what is that? How does that show up? And what can we do about it?
Exactly. Yeah. I guess the word I'm looking for, it's easy to throw kids away and think they're just bad kids, or these are bad adults on the back end.
So I think one thing to take a look at is that kind of how this trauma impacts people. What it does is that it impacts them, their cognition, their abilities to pay attention, and their social pieces. So all those go into play with kids in school. So if kids are having cognitive issues, trauma can cause diminished IQ, slowed language development. In one study, they talked about how kindergartners are scoring below average in reading and math when they've experienced trauma. So with that, then you have dropout or delinquency attached to that. And then with attention, they're three times more likely to have problems with paying attention if they've experienced trauma. And we know how that can impact school, as well as socially. They have difficulty with self-regulation, and that can lead to aggression and outburst, which can lead to suspensions and aggression at school too as well. So those are some of the things that we might see. So we need people to be aware that those are responses to trauma and not just willful behavior of children, so that we can address it differently and look at them differently.
I guess what's kind of scary to me about that in the school system is those are pathways to prison.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key paradigm shifts that the trauma-informed building resilience movement encourages is changing the paradigm from asking the question, this includes educators, but it includes all of us, from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And so, and then understanding that somebody's experiences then affects their behaviors and their life choices. So that knowledge, that awareness then, of understanding that oftentimes people are very much almost unwillingly, especially kids, you know, engaging in behaviors over which they have very little control. They don't know why they're lashing out or why they're exploding in the classroom. But helping teachers understand what's going on and then giving teachers and educators and other individuals that work with kids the tools to respond to that appropriately, that's a really important part of this work.
And I understand that a part of your work that you're doing now is trying to get local trainers. What is that? Local trainers and what? And to whom would they provide this training?
So we have been working with the Michigan ACEs Initiative to develop a cadre of local trainers that will be able to provide additional support about what trauma is and how to create trauma-informed environments, responding to trauma, understanding trauma. Those trainers are actually going to be able to train other trainers. That's our long-term vision. But for now, those individuals are raising awareness about it. So we are working on those kinds of trainers. We also are lucky enough to have a few different organizations in our community that have already been training about trauma. We have the Children's Trauma Assessment Center. Family and Children's Services has done some training about what trauma is, as has Community Mental Health.
So these trainers would be training just the mental health community?
Anybody
who asks for it?
Mm-hmm.
Would there be a charge for this training?
There is no charge.
Interesting.
And the training can be tailored to different groups, too. So the nice thing about how the ACE study and the training was laid out is that it can be a 20-minute presentation, very tailored. It could be a 3-hour showing of resilience and a discussion, and it can be tailored to the different groups. So depending on what your interest is and how you might be interacting with individuals or children or families, the training can be focused on what you would need to know.
Now, this particular showing is at the medical school. So those that are training to become physicians hopefully will attend this. So this is an issue that shows up in the doctor's office as well. What is it that they can do?
That's a complicated question.
I would think so.
And that's a question that a lot of physicians have asked. And when we've spoken with other physicians in the area that have been leading in this work, one of them is Dr. Leah Gugino. She's been working with us and talking to us about us and said, that's the question, right? It really, and Diane mentioned this earlier, is a compelling argument for an integrated model of care. First, you want to understand that a lot of these challenges that your patient is experiencing are often a result of this trauma. And then second, how do you support that individual with more than just medicine? Not that medicine isn't a good support, but also mental health supports to provide a comprehensive intervention for the challenges that your patients are experiencing.
I do think, though, that in our society today, people are more likely to go to a physician first, maybe before seeking any type of mental health support. So I think it is important for physicians to be aware that some of the symptoms that their patients are telling them could be related to more of a mental health issue that could be worked on differently than just medicine alone. So a patient could come in saying that they're having difficulty sleeping, that they have a lack of an appetite, that they are feeling nervous or jumpy. So those are physical symptoms, but they're also symptoms of that trauma manifestation and some emotional issues that can be worked on through mental health supports.
There's a doctor, a pediatrician that's focused, that is featured in the particular film Resilience that you're showing, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who's out of California, and she's kind of a leader in this particular area. And if I heard correctly, I thought that what she was doing is routinely screening children who come in for ACEs. How popular is that work? Could you speak to that, Ms. Nottingham?
Sure. Medicaid actually in Michigan approved using the ACE screening tool as one way to assess incoming children. Not a lot of doctors do it yet, but some do, and they're permitted to do that. as a caution there, it isn't supposed to be actually given to the children to fill out themselves. It's supposed to be given to the adults to fill out on behalf of the child. But by understanding what an ACE score is, because a kid with an ACE score of 0 that shows behavior issues might require a very different kind of intervention than a kid with an ACE score of 6. You know, you're going to say, okay, so this kid probably requires really a medical intervention if you have an ACE score of 0. If your ACE score is 6, this child has some significant challenges in their life, and they're going to need comprehensive supports to mitigate some of those challenges.
So what you're saying is the ACE screening is being used it can be used, mm-hmm. but mostly right now in Michigan for families on Medicaid?
Yes, that is currently what's being done most of the time when it is used. And Dr. Gugino also has introduced with a couple of other physicians using that screener to help inform practice as well. So it's starting, but the movement is in its infancy.
And what I'd be curious about, is there a difference in income? Because people can be trauma across many income groups, just like we're seeing with the opioid crisis right now. So I'm just curious, is there any differences in terms of how often we might see ACEs in a low-income population versus other income stratas, if it's known?
Well, I think what we do know and what is interesting is that the original ACE study was actually done in a clinic where most of the people had more than a high school diploma and were economically in what we'd call more that middle class. So their ACE scores were that high, even in that situation where they had resources for education and jobs and employment.
It sounds like this ACE screening tool would be good for any family, you know, not just those on Medicaid. It would seem there's something I was going to ask you about that. Well, while I think of that, what haven't I asked you that you want to say?
I think we had talked about kind of what it can do to a child and some of those reactions and responses. So then you had mentioned, like, how do the schools respond? But there, as Jennifer had mentioned, we want to have a community response to helping people. So there are things that, you know, doctors can identify. There are things that the schools can do. There are things that parents can do, mental health professionals. So we want to take this from lots of different angles. But there are some commonalities in kind of looking at that. So many of the responses and treatments that we want to look at for people that have experienced trauma have some of those cognitive behavioral principles embedded into them. So we want to first educate people about the impact of trauma. So not just someone generally in the community too, but if I have experienced trauma, I need to be educated about what it's doing to me and my brain so I can understand myself better. We need to help children and parents establish or reestablish a sense of safety in their lives that's necessary for any healing or treatment. Then we need to look at teaching techniques for dealing with those overwhelming emotional responses. We talked about how that fight or flight kind of takes over. And so how do we teach someone to deal with that when there isn't that real threat present? And then we need to have that opportunity to talk about the traumatic experiences in that safe, accepting environment. And that's difficult for people to listen to what's happened to someone. But we need to be able to allow people who've experienced that to be able to share and talk about those things.
I now remember what my question is. I think this ACE thing is very important, you know, what you're doing. But I'm just curious, how honest do you think people are in the ACE screening? And I'm just wondering if parents might be fearful that something adverse is going to happen to them or their children by being honest.
The way that the screening is administered is that parents don't necessarily have to reveal what ACEs the child has. They just have to reveal the number of ACEs.
Okay.
And so that is a safety mechanism to some extent. They don't have to say there's domestic abuse going on. You know, there is physical and or sexual abuse happening in the home, which creates some sense of safety. I think what they have found is that most of the time parents, because they love their kids, if they're taking the screening, they want the best for their kids and they'll be reasonably honest.
The other way to take a look at this is that actually the ACE screener was originally set up for someone who's over the age of 18 to answer those questions about their childhood. And that still gives us information because what we're finding is that some of these traumatic experiences are generational. And so if we can even assess that adult who may have a child, they may not currently be living in a domestic violence situation, but if they as the adult grew up in a domestic violence situation, that's still going to impact their parenting and their children. And so we want to know that so we can offer different ways for them to address their own issues as well.
As we close, a final question that I think of as I was reading the material, which was interesting to me, is that maybe some people might think that they don't present right now. But the interesting thing is that this can have kind of a boomerang effect later on as an adult, having lots of ACEs. Could you speak to that?
ACEs can have a significant long-term impact on health. So there will be individuals that had a significant amount of adverse childhood experiences, but perhaps are extremely resilient. So they've had other protective factors in their life. And therefore, they go around and they seem to live pretty normal lives. You know, they maybe get college degrees and or have a professional career. But what they find is that there will be inexplicable health issues sometimes. I have lung cancer. I've never smoked a day in my life is something you'll hear. You know, or I have heart disease and I eat and I well and I exercise. So it actually changes the stressful experiences, the getting back to the physiology, the adrenaline and the cortisol actually affect our DNA. It affects what are called the telomeres, which are the caps on the end of the DNA that protect it and allow it to replicate in healthy ways. It compromises that, shortening the telomeres and actually affecting the way our body operates. And so even if someone feels like, I'm over it, I'm okay, it will still potentially manifest itself in a lot of different ways for that are related to their health. Now, that being said, and I think this is one of the things that the film does really well, having a high number of adverse childhood experiences is not a death sentence. There are things that you can do to offset the impact of those stressors. And Diane referred to several of those in terms of caring adult relationships, creating social networks for yourself and for your children. The impact of a single caring adult in someone's life can be extremely powerful in offsetting the impact of adverse childhood experiences. Practices like mindfulness and meditation actually can rewire the brain and heal DNA. And mindfulness used to be kind of, and meditation used to be sort of reserved for the people that do a lot of yoga and eat a lot of kale. But now what physicians are realizing is it's one of the most powerful ways to rewire the brain. So things can be done. And I think, if anything, that's a really important message to take away. Adverse childhood experiences are not the end of the world, but we do need to address them and do something about them.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jennifer Nottingham, Associate Director of Community Impact for the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo Region, and Diane Marquez, Director of Behavioral Services at Family and Children Services. In preparation for the showing of the film Resilience, the Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope, being shown at the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker School of Medicine on November 14th.
It's from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. And the one thing that I'd like to add is if a community member is listening and is interested in attending a screening and hosting a screening and becoming a mentor for someone, they can visit United Way's website at changethestory.org or email us at getinvolved@uwbckr.org. And we'd be happy to talk with them and find out what information would be especially helpful.
For registration information to see a screening of the Resilience documentary coming up on November 14th and a second one now scheduled for December 11th at KRESA, visit WMUK.org. The film had its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in 2016. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.